Hello, this is Bob Krueger with Thought for Food for October of 2018. This program is heard on the third Wednesday of the month at 4 p.m. and repeated on the third Saturday of the month at 3 p.m. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired, but hopefully will be of interest to everyone. October is National Apple Month, although earlier ripening varieties have been picked before this month begins. Yom Kippur begins on the 8th. We observe Columbus Day on the 14th. The U.S. Navy was established on October the 13th in 1775. We end the month with Halloween on the 31st. October is also Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and my great-grandson will be 4 years old on October the 1st. We begin National Apple Month with an apple story. After more than a half century as apple's most grown apple, the Red Delicious is on track to be ousted this year by a sweet, juicy young upstart, the Gala. That's according to the U.S. Apple Association, a trade group which releases its production forecast in 2018 in early September. "It's just the beginning of the end," said Tom Burford, an apple historian, orchard consultant, and Red Delicious detractor. "How are you going to market a tasteless apple when the consumer has tasted so many good apples?" Despite his bias, Burford has a point. The decline of the Red Delicious with its mild flavor and often mealy texture can be credited to a shift in consumer preferences toward apples that are crunchier, crisper, and sweeter. "It's the industry adapting to the consumer's demand," said Mark Seaton, the director of industry affairs for the Apple Association, who, unlike Burford, is more sanguine about the apple variety's future. "The Red Delicious is still projected to be the second most popular apple by production in America, according to the group, which claims 7,500 growers as members. The Granny Smith will be third, followed by the Fuji and the fast-growing Honeycrisp, which could rise to third place as soon as 2020, just 3 decades after its introduction," the trade group says. The Red Delicious enjoyed relative popularity for decades, but took off in the mid-20th century. To meet the demands of customers who began to associate the color red with ripeness, apple growers and supermarkets produced and sold ever redder apples at the expense of flavor. In recent decades, the train has started to reverse itself. The Honeycrisp, for example, has soared in popularity since it was developed at the University of Minnesota and released in 1991. Along with developing a redder apple, they also bred an apple that would travel well. About 25% of our nation's apples are grown in the state of Washington. The bulk of North Carolina's apple production is in our mountain regions. They say some like it hot. Don't put peppers in the corner. Sure, they're hot and spicy as if flames could grow on a plant. But don't sleep on their sweeter side, the side that isn't searing, but more warmly and tingly. Pepperfest took place September 23rd at the Briar Chapel community between Chapel Hill and Pittsburgh, the event's home for most of the past decade. Organizers say attendance has outgrown this residential community and that it'll be moved nearby for next year, although a location is yet to be determined. Pepperfest is hosted by Sustainable Advocates Abundance North Carolina and celebrates the bounty of Carolina peppers, which includes some of the hottest on earth and cooler varieties first bred here. The annual event hooks up local farmers who grow peppers with chefs who cook them and a public that can't seem to get enough of them, no matter how many times they've been burned. Pepperfest started in 2007 as a one-off tasting event for a new kind of cooled-off Habanero developed by local farmer Doug Jones. The festival has grown into an annual gathering of those who like it hot, attracting nearly 3,000 people, eating up about a half a ton of Chatham County peppers. About 50 restaurants, breweries, distilleries, and food artisans will craft dishes and brews highlighting North Carolina peppers. If you like it hot, you may want to put Pepperfest on your calendar for next year. Raleigh's restaurant scene is now entering its artisan ice phase. The North Hills shopping development has landed another big fish, a seafood restaurant called Stir. An oyster and cocktail bar will open in Raleigh's North Hills development next year. This will be the second location for the Chattanooga, Tennessee-based restaurant that's owned by Square One Holdings of Tennessee. Square One also owns Chapel Hill Carolina Brewery, one of the oldest breweries in the Triangle. Stir's oyster menu will range from house to premium from a number of oyster-growing regions, served raw on the half shell as well as broiled, fried, and grilled. The restaurant's Chattanooga menu includes small plates of salmon cakes and truffle flies with ranch dressing for dipping, entrees including shrimp and grits, steak frites, pastas, fish, and tuna poke. The restaurant's Chattanooga location had an ice chef on staff cutting cubes from a giant block into 8 different shapes, served according to the cocktail. Stir will be located on the ground floor of the Bank of America Tower in North Hills, near where the development's recent addition, Rosewater Restaurant, will be located. Between North Hills and the Dillon in downtown Raleigh, developer John Kane has added a number of upscale, out-of-the-market restaurants to the area, including Barcelona Wine Bar, Vietnamese-focused company, and Oakwood Steakhouse. The question has been asked, why is pimento cheese so big in the South? Really, world? You still think the South is weird because we love pimento cheese? Even though it's been spreaded through the rest of the world, particularly in the hand of inventive chefs, it still puzzles and intimidates people who didn't grow up with it. Amanda Magnus is originally from Maryland and even lived in Wisconsin, the land of cheese. But until she moved to Durham earlier this year, she had never encountered pimento cheese. Magnus turned to Curious North Carolina, a joint venture between the Charlotte Observer, the News and Observer, and the Durham Herald Sun, that invites readers to submit questions about North Carolina for reporters to answer. They have a lot of experience in tackling the many mysteries of pimento cheese. I still haven't tried it, Magnus admits. I don't exactly understand what it is. How did someone create this, and why is it associated with the South? It's easy to explain what pimento cheese is. Shredded or grated cheddar cheese, preferably extra sharp, mixed with mayonnaise and chopped pimentos. Even it has only 3 basic ingredients, each is fiercely debated. Duke's versus Hellman's mayonnaise, the sharpness of the cheddar, how it is grated from fine to coarse, whether roasted red peppers are an acceptable substitute for pimentos. If you do it, we suggest not mentioning it out loud in certain circles. What is harder to understand is how it started and why it's considered Southern. While some sources claim it was started with subsidized cheese as a cheap form of protein during the Depression, the recipe is actually much older. Versions of pimento cheese show up in Southern cookbooks in the late 19th and early 20th century. It may have become popular in the South because it didn't spoil easily at room temperature, making it easy to pack in lunchboxes, particularly for textile workers. But it's also fashionable in tea rooms. At cocktail parties from the 1930s through the 1960s, it was a popular spread to serve with crackers and celery sticks, or to turn into cheese balls for holiday parties. It also became famous as a go-to sandwich at the Masters Golf Tournament in Augusta, Georgia. While pimento cheese was mostly homemade for much of the 20th century, it has had a resonance in the last 10 years with a number of good quality brands of pimento cheese available in local grocery stores. And I'm one who had never seen or tasted pimento cheese until I came to the South. We know that Butterball, the company known for their turkeys, is based in Garner and have multiple facilities throughout southeastern North Carolina. So the question arises, with all the flooding in our state, how will this affect turkey prices for Thanksgiving? According to the company, many of our North Carolina-based processing plants hatcheries and feed mills have been impacted by the storm, and we continue to see flooding and power outages in the region. This has impacted much of our North Carolina operations. The company said it didn't expect its losses from Florence to be significant because of their prior preparations, nor should this lead to any pre-Thanksgiving shortage, as Butterball points out that those birds come from the Midwest. The company says its North Carolina operations process ground turkey, turkey bacon, and turkey breasts. But if they're working turkey breasts, they must have been working on the whole bird, it would seem to me. Are you a milk drinker? Milk is far from trendy, with a crowd of breakfast beverages options and milk alternatives. Americans have been drinking less dairy for decades, but while the sales of skim milk have plummeted, whole milk is growing more popular, bringing in $5.3 billion, that's with a B, dollars last year, according to market research firm Mintel. One of the bright spots is that consumers are moving to higher fat milk, said Carrie Fry, senior vice president of the regulatory affairs at the International Dairy Foods Association, known as IDFA, a trade group representing dairy manufacturers and marketers. Whole milk, which is made with 3.25% milk fat, now accounts for 38% of the milk market, compared with 29% 5 years ago, she said. And whole milk's rising reputation is due in part to recent studies that have challenged the long-held belief that low-fat milk is nutritionally superior, since it contains fewer calories and less saturated fat. Focusing on low fat is predominantly based on the assumption that saturated fat increases the LDL cholesterol, said Majid Dehagen, a nutritional epidemiologist at the Population Health Research Institute in Canada. But full-fat dairy also contains plenty of nutrients, including vitamin K, magnesium, and protein, and some research suggests that fatty acids and microbes in these products may help regulate blood sugar and insulin levels. The U.S. dietary guidelines still recommend low and no-fat dairy, but new research suggests that the full-fat dairy may be a healthy choice. Last month, Dehagen and her colleagues published an observational study in The Lancet, finding that people who ate 3 servings of dairy per day, especially the whole-fat kind, had lower risk of early death, cardiovascular disease, and stroke than those who ate less than a serving a day. Other research finds that people who eat full fat are no more likely to develop heart disease than those who eat low-fat versions, and even be less prone to type 2 diabetes and weight gain, probably because they stay full longer. Studies also found people who cut their fat intake tend to replace the missing calories with unhealthy refined carbohydrates. Talking about me. The message seems to be resonating with shoppers, bolstered by new offerings from brands like Chobani and Stonyfield. The whole-fat yogurt sales increased 25% from 2016 to 2017, according to the Dairy Institute. The best sellers at Siggy's, which makes thick Icelandic-style yogurt with milk fat contents ranging from 0 to 9% is still fat-free vanilla. But the whole milk products are catching up really, really fast, says the company's founder, Siggy Hilmarsson. There's definitely been a big shift. The likely explanation, it tastes delicious, he said. For this reason, Fry predicts that the high-fat dairy craze will persist. The research that's been evolving and has been in the general press has given consumers permission to choose products that they like, she says. The latest thing in the milk area are plant-based milks. Non-dairy alternatives like almond, soy, and coconut milk are the fastest-growing beverages, perhaps because 39% of Americans are trying to eat a more plant-based diet. A 2017 survey by the research firm Nielsen found. While cow's milk is still a much larger market than plant-based beverages, sales of plant milks rose by 61% from 2012 to January of 2018, and they raked in an estimated $2.11 billion, that's with that B again, last year, according to Mintel. But plant milks are also a subject of controversy. Well, the dairy industry's support, the Food and Drug Administration, is mulling a policy that would bar brands from calling non-animal products milk. The agency is accepting public comment and will make a decision soon. Whatever they're called, non-dairy drinks aren't going anywhere. New options like Kiowa, oat, and even peanut butter milk are hitting the shelves all the time. Speaking of beverages, as consumers shy away from sugary soft drinks, Coca-Cola has found a new way to cater to them. Serve them coffee. The U.S. beverage giant says it plans to buy Costa, one of the world's biggest coffee chains, for $5.1 billion in cash. The deal, Coke's biggest ever acquisition of a brand, surpassing its 2007 takeover of Vitamin Water, shows just how much the company is willing to spend to keep up with changing tastes. The takeover will make it the third largest player in the coffee shop industry, well behind Starbucks and just behind McDonald's. But Coke's latest bet will also plunge the company deep into a war over coffee consumption in all forms that's being waged by a pair of food giants. One is Nestle's, which owns both Nescafe Instant Coffee and the high-end Blue Bottle chain, and which recently closed a $7.5 billion deal, that's B again, for the exclusive marketing rights to Starbucks packaged coffee and tea. The other is JAB, the acquisitive European conglomerate that has remade the coffee industry through a spending spree, picking up smaller chains like Pete's Coffee and Stumptown, as well as Keurig's Green Mountain, the maker of the single-serve coffee machines. In all of their sites is a fast-growing consumption of coffee around the world, as well as myriad ways that Java can be served, from complex creations in coffee shops to pods that can be dropped into machines at home. Global coffee sales, including the instant variety, are forecast to grow 15.6% by 2022, according to the market researcher Aero Monitor, outpacing the growth in sales of soft drinks. Though Coke will gain its first significant retail footprint through this deal, the company appears more interested in using its vast distribution network to help sell Costa products in grocery stores and restaurants. Another coffee story. Dunkin' is dropping the donuts from its name anyway. Donuts are still on the menu, but the company is renaming itself Dunkin' to reflect its increased emphasis on coffee and other drinks. The change will officially take place in January when the new name will start appearing on napkins, boxes, and signs at its U.S. stores. The name change will eventually be adopted by their international stores. The 68-year-old chain says its new logo will still have the familiar round font and orange and pink color scheme that the company has used since 1973. And I read somewhere where somebody said they were going to run and get all of the napkins and other memorabilia of Dunkin', so they think they might be available. Almost all of us use mayonnaise in our kitchen, but which brand do you use and why do you choose that brand? Mayonnaise looks creamy, but it has no cream. It's mostly oil and water with a touch of egg, vinegar, and salt. That's why a 1 tablespoon serving has only 1.5 grams of saturated fat. Sodium is low, too. Mayos typically range from 7 to 130 milligrams per tablespoon, and most mayos that add sugar contain so little, less than a half a gram per tablespoon, that it shows up as zero on the nutrition facts label. Don't break the bank for fancy oils. The new kid on the block is avocado oil. Chosen Foods, Primal Kitchen, and Sir Kensington sell mayos made with avocado oil, but a 12-ounce jar will set you back from $7 to $10. Hellman's and Kraft's avocado oil mayos are cheaper because they're blended with canola and soy oils. Avocado oil is better for you than the oils used in most mayonnaise, says Chosen Foods. Not really. Most mayos are made with soy, olive, and or canola oil. Like avocado oil, they're largely unsaturated, but soy oil is richer in polyunsaturated fats, which can lower LDL, the bad cholesterol, more than the monounsaturated fats in avocado, olive, and canola oil. One alternative is to go vegan. Vegan mayos are in. They keep their oil emulsified by replacing mayo's eggs with pea protein. But if you're not vegan, there's no need to go eggless for your health's sake. Regular mayo has a trivial 5 to 15 milligrams of cholesterol per tablespoon. A large egg yolk is 185 milligrams, about 60% of a day's worth. Cage-free, read closely. Made with cage-free whole eggs, says Kraft's olive oil mayo. The label's fine print contains at least 65% cage-free whole eggs. The real story. In 2016, Kraft promised to go 100% cage-free by 2025, but Hellman beat Kraft to the punch. It was using 100% cage-free eggs since 2017. Consider calories. Regular mayonnaise has 90 to 100 calories per tablespoon. If you want to try, you want to go lower, try a lighter, reduced fat variety. Most have 40 to 60 calories. So do some non-lights, like Just. That's a brand, 60 calories, but not every low-calorie mayo wows the taste buds. A good bet, Hellman's Light. Other ideas for using mayonnaise, think beyond sandwiches. Whisking a touch of mayo into your homemade salad dressing can keep the oil and vinegar from separating, and the inventive new crop of flavored mayos can stand in for sauces and more. What does your favorite stand up with? How does your favorite stand up with these requirements? Tyson Foods, one of the world's largest meat producers, announced that its president and chief executive officer, Tom Hayes, will step down at the end of the end of September for personal reasons. Tyson's board of directors says his group president of beef, pork, and international divisions, Noel White, will succeed Mr. Hayes. Gary Mickelson, Tyson's spokesman, did not elaborate on Hayes' resignation but said, "There are no issues of personal conduct or integrity." Hayes joined Tyson in 2014 with its acquisition of the Hillshire Brand Company, where he was chief supply officer. In 2016, he was appointed first president and then CEO of the Springdale, Arkansas-based firm. It's a very difficult decision to leave Tyson Food, but after careful consideration and discussion with my family and board, I know it's the right thing to do, Mr. Hayes said in a statement. Tyson said White had been with the company since 2001 when it acquired beef and pork producer, the Iowa Beef Packers. We all know that the Hurricane Florence caused incredible damage to much of North Carolina, but it really comes home when a cost is applied. North Carolina farmers and livestock growers will suffer more than $1.1 billion in losses as a result of Hurricane Florence, according to the State Department of Agriculture. The biggest losses will be among farmers who grow crops such as corn, soybeans, and tobacco. The hurricane came ashore just as farmers were beginning their fall harvest and lingered for several days. We knew the losses would be significant because it was harvest time for so many of our major crops, and the storm hit our top six agriculture counties especially hard, Agriculture Commissioner Steve Troxler said. These early estimates show just what a devastating and staggering blow this hurricane leveled at our agricultural industry. In addition to row crops, the state estimates loss of nearly $70 million to commercial forests, $30 million for lawn and landscape growers, nearly $27 million for vegetables, and about $23 million for livestock, poultry, and aquaculture growers. The state based its estimates on the portions of the crops remaining in the field in 35 counties hit hardest by the storm. They also looked at the average crop production in those counties over the past 5 years and the current price of commodities. One of the largest craft beer competitions in the country found a lot to like in North Carolina. The Great American Beer Festival, an annual gathering in Colorado with thousands of breweries, awarded nearly a dozen medals to North Carolina breweries, including 6 gold medals statewide. Locally, Crank Arm in Raleigh was the biggest winner, bringing home a gold medal in the American Belgio style category for its white wall wheat. The beer is a hoppy wheat beer that drinks like a crisp session IPA, but with little bitterness. White wheat previously won a bronze medal from the Great American Beer Festival in 2016. High Points Brown Truck Brewery won a silver medal in the same American Belgio style category for its number 4.5 dry hop Saison. On Instagram, Crack Arm suggested a collaboration between the winners, which along with California's The Brewery represents a shuffling of the same gold, silver, and bronze medal winners from 2 years ago. Other triangle winners this year included a silver medal for Carolina Brewery's Copper Line Amber Ale in the ordinary or special bitter category, and a bronze medal for Little City's Mosaic Reprisal in the Session IPA category. Breweries from Boone, Canton, Charlotte, and Greensboro also won medals. A systematic review and meta-analysis of random controlled trials published in the journal Clinical Nutrition found that vegetarian-style dietary patterns may be helpful in diabetes management. The 9 trials included in the analysis included 664 predominantly middle-aged, overweight, or obese participants with type 2 diabetes controlled by medication for an average of 12 weeks. The evidence suggested that moderate, certainly, a vegetarian dietary pattern improved glycemic control, cholesterol levels, and body weight in individuals with diabetes with a mix of different non-vegetarian dietary patterns, including conventional diabetic diets and usual American diets. The authors suggest that the high content of fiber, unsaturated fats, and phytochemicals in a vegetarian diet may help explain observed benefits. The results... We've run out of time for today's episode of Thought for Food. Be sure and listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Bob Kruger, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.